This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network. Today on the James Altucher Show.
When my music became popular, everyone, you know, out of the goodness of their heart, they all wanted to say congrats. I knew statistically and intellectually that artists put songs out and every once in a while they have a hit. They're lucky if they get one. They're even lucky if they get two. I felt like, well, I'm different. My first one was a hit, so all of mine will be hits now. Then each song I put out after that was progressively less and less popular, and I progressively became less and less popular until I was left alone in a million-dollar house in L.A. with an empty schedule and sort of nothing to do.
I imagine you attached a little bit of your self-worth to those numbers.
Yeah, I touched not only my self-worth, but my self-identity. Who I thought I was Mr. Popular, Mr. Successful. I had to redefine how I thought of who I was. And it was the best thing that ever could have happened to me.
Which people always say after the fact,
yeah.
But feels really bad at the bottom. I think people who work a standard, let's say, day job, and I hate to put it that way, but they feel like there's the artist and then there's me. But I think anyone could be an artist in their life by living out, bit by bit, their beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest art piece you and I are working on is our lives. At the end of the day, that's the big painting. You know, and each day we get to add a color or maybe erase a stroke here and there.
I really want to be as mentally tough as possible. This is such an important skill to have for success in life. So if you want to be mentally tougher, you just got to be tougher. How to get lucky? Wake up earlier and make luck happen. You have to get discipline and you have to get freedom. Jocko Willink, one of my favorite people in the world and an ex-guest on this podcast, will show you how with his new book, Discipline Equals Freedom. Discipline Equals Freedom by Jocko Willink. Get it wherever books are sold from St. Martin's Press. I've got Mike Posner here. Mike, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Mike, I don't even know where to introduce you. I'll just say you're an amazing songwriter, singer. You're also now, or you've probably always been, but a huge YouTube star. One of your songs, I Took a Pill in Ibiza. Is that how you say it? Ibiza?
Yeah, that's how I say it. They say it a little
850
different.
Million views, almost a billion views. Mm. I don't want to say that's the highlight of your career or anything. That's just the latest thing. Your first big hit was Cooler Than Me in 2009. You've done songs, podcasts, books of poetry. You've written hit songs for Justin Bieber, Maroon 5. You've reinvented yourself several times. You've dealt with ups and downs, depressions, failure, success. We're going to talk about all of it.
Great.
But actually, one thing I wanted to start with, I love how you took a backdoor way to success in your very first release. Mm. So you were a junior at Duke University.
Correct.
And you had that first song, was it the song on the album? You released it on iTunes University instead of straight through iTunes.
Yeah.
And that became, of course, number one on iTunes University because it's going to be much more interesting than any, you know, university stuff.
Sure.
And that kind of propelled you into success. How'd you think of that idea?
Well,
and I just want to interrupt one second before you answer.
Sure.
I do think, obviously, being a singer and a songwriter, there's so much competition out there. You're clearly amazing. There's a lot of talented and amazing people, and they just give up right away because they think, oh, if they don't go that standard path of like label, tour, hit, whatever, they just give up. And you kind of found this. I think finding that backdoor way is a key to success in many areas of life. So, okay, Annie.
Yeah, at the time, it didn't feel like a back door. It just felt like the only door, you know? So I was just...
Why did it feel like the only door? Couldn't you have gone to like a label and
sure,
toured
around?
Sure,
I could have. I actually think I did maybe the summer before as a producer with like what we call like a beat CD. So I would make these instrumental beds for rappers or R&B singers to sing on, and I'd get meetings with like a lower level person at record labels and playing my stuff, and they'd say thank you for coming in, etc. And until, you know, and labels are good at taking fires that have already started and pouring gasoline on them. They're not so good at starting fires.
That's true for many industries. So like publishers might publish a lot of books, but they'll definitely throw the fire on the books that really have, they'll tell everybody the same thing. We're going to throw our whole marketing muscle behind you.
Yeah,
but they'll really put the marketing
on,
behind the big ones.
And it's kind of on you to get that fire started. So that's what I was doing. I was a student at Duke University. I had, you know, like a $200 microphone in my dorm room and software that I had stolen off the internet and recorded what we call a mixtape. A mixtape is basically a free album in hip hop culture. And a lot of times it involves your music and it can involve remixes of existing songs.
You did like a Beyonce remix on that first one?
Correct, yeah, Beyonce remix.
Did you need to buy the rights?
That's the thing about mixtapes is they're free. And at the time, I mean, it's become a little dicier now, but at the time, like the culture was, you just made this thing for free and put it on the internet. And you would leverage your relationships so you could get features like, you know, most notably on my first mixtape, there's a rapper who's become a very prominent rapper now. His name is Big Sean.
Yeah.
And he was on my mixtape 3 times. And none of these guys get paid. They just like, we're friends. And then, you know, when I'm doing my mixtape, you'll do a verse type of thing. And, you know, you don't clear anything. So I recorded this little project in my dorm room and I put it online and my music was sort of garnering this attention in like the niche hip hop community on like hip hop blogs and things like that. So I knew my stuff would kind of get heard that way, but I was noticing that like the prissy white girls at Duke University also somehow impossibly were into my music too. Like,
because I feel like it's not like pure hip hop, even Cooler Than Me, definitely got
it's melodic,
the beat and hip hop feel. But there's kind of melodic, and there's a ballad sort of feel in the lyrics.
Sure,
you know, I could see how it's relatable depending on where you're connecting with it.
Yeah, at the time I started rapping when I was 8, and by this time I was about 20. And I don't know why, but I decided to start singing my raps. So that's basically what my music at that time sounded like. It was like melodic hip hop. And so I put this thing out and you know, it's getting on the blogs, etc. But I realized that the girls at my school wouldn't go to those blogs and they weren't going to be able to hear my music or get it on their computer, their iPod, unless I had it in a more universal place. And I wasn't the first one to do it, but I had seen other bands get their albums on iTunes U, which was this arm of iTunes set up for professors to post their lectures for free. And I found out who ran the iTunes U department at Duke. He happened to be from my hometown, Southfield, Michigan, Todd Stavely. We talked. He said, yeah, I can put your album on there. And so now I had my music in this safe, universal place, but it was free. That was the big thing, James. On iTunes U, it's free. And at the time, everyone was pirating everything, especially in colleges. We had good internet.
Right.
So like, I remember stealing Kanye's album, Graduation, a week before it came out. So I knew no one was going to pay for my music because no one knew who the hell I was. And so getting on iTunes in this safe place, but also it being free was.
When you say safe place, what do you mean by that?
Like the alternative for these blogs was you would click a Z-Share link. And at the time, I don't know if they have Z-Share link, but there was like, you'd click the link and then all these ads would pop up and it'd be like, it's kind of something tricking you to click somewhere else. And you'd kind of have to find where the actual download link was and you'd have to right click it and hit save like link as type of thing. So it was just like kind of hard and confusing and didn't seem like as safe as iTunes or like as clean as iTunes.
Yeah. So.
But it was important that it was in both places for me.
But iTunes U kind of, it's almost as if like it lends the legitimacy of Apple you know, to the songs, even though you're not on the standard iTunes, you're all, hey, I'm on iTunes. Yeah, it's iTunes U, and people were finding it there.
Yeah.
It's a discovery mechanism. People don't go to the blogs unless you're a huge fan, but everyone goes to iTunes to shop.
Right. And we did, by the time I did it, a second mixtape I put on there and it got taken down.
Oh, they were like, no more music.
Well, they're like, it's not really educational
but could you,
material.
Could you just put it on iTunes then, or you needed a label?
Well, I put my albums on iTunes now, but I made another mixtape, which wasn't cleared, had features and remixes of people who I hadn't paid, etc. Like, did a favor, or, you know, a remix of a song, someone else's song that I hadn't talked to. And so that I can put on regular iTunes, unless I sort all that out.
And so
my albums, everything is sorted.
Once you were on iTunes U, though, how did people then? Of course, other, like you mentioned, other people were putting on iTunes U. It was a breakout album on iTunes U. It hit number one for the whole iTunes U. How did you get it known, or were people sharing it, or what do you think was the reason why it spread?
Sure, good question, and that goes back to starting the fire, right? It's like, you can tell as many people you want about something that isn't good, and it doesn't really matter, you know? They're not going to tell anyone else. So I think the real unsexy answer to your question is, I had been making music 12 years at this point, and I stunk pretty bad, you know, the first 10 of them.
Huh.
And I spent, you know, that first decade, you know, the first 2 years was just getting used to hearing my own voice recorded, because it sounded so different than, I don't know if you experienced this, the first time you record your voice sounds different than it does in your head.
I have yet to listen to one of my podcasts.
Yeah, I mean, for that reason. So that took like 2 years, you know, maybe ages 8 to 10. You know?
But this is an interesting thing though, like, so, and this is a common thing that I hear on here, is that everybody goes through that. So even, I mean, you certainly started with probably two things. A love for music, obviously, or you wouldn't have done it at the age of 8. Like, why? No one's going to force you to do rap music at the age of 8. But you also probably had some talent, but it required, like you said, 10 years, 12 years of developing skills to launch that talent. Like, what percent do you think is talent, and what percent do you think is skill development?
Great question. It's never been posed to me that way. And I'm so glad that you pose it that way. I would say 20% talent, 80% skill development.
And the talent, I wonder if the talent and the love of it feed off of each other. Like, if you didn't have the talent, maybe you wouldn't love it. And if you didn't love it, maybe you wouldn't have had the impetus to really develop the talent.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. You ever have a song pop in your head?
Yeah.
So I have songs.
I took a pill in Ibiza.
So sometimes I have songs pop in my head too a lot. Sometimes I have songs pop in my head that I have never heard before and no one's ever heard before. So my job is to then get that recorded the way I hear it in my head. So the second part of that is largely skill. Like, you know, how many colors on your palette do you have to develop? How many relations, like if you hear a symphony, do you have the relationships and the wherewithal to get the right engineer and the right arranger, you know, et cetera? A lot of that is skill. But the first part of that, I don't know if you can learn that, to hear something in your head.
So that's really interesting. So, because I think also you skipped a valley of skills also required, which is you hear something in your head, then you have to know, what key was that to even write down the music? And then what instrument should I use, and which parts should be sung and which parts should be played?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, and you've had, in your career, you've had various feelings about how strong the lyrics should be and versus the other instruments. And so it's kind of like you have to develop all these sub-skills. Like,
yeah.
Maybe there's like 30 or 40 sub-skills to
a
actually
lot.
Get out of your head into
it's
a piece
lot.
Of paper.
Yeah. And to be clear, it's not usually not a full song, right? It pops in my head. A lot of times it's like a melody or a chorus or something like that, and you have to fill in the rest. So that again is like, you have to have skill set to like kind of fill in the gaps around this spark.
And also, clearly you're a songwriter, like you've written songs for other people like even Justin Bieber and Maroon 5 we already mentioned, but you've written a whole range of songs. You've written a book of poetry. You have a very strong relationship with words and the words in these songs. But you also, how involved are you in, like you just said, you hear something in your head that's relating to the melody and the actual song itself. Often I feel that's disconnected, that there's a songwriter and then there's the person who puts it into a song. Mm-hmm. But you're both.
Yeah, most of the time. Like you said, sometimes someone else will sing it.
Yeah. Well, then there's the singing it and the performing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I really, you know, the problem is sometimes when you write songs, and I spent a few years of my life trying to be like a writer and a producer and not an artist. And I found it very stifling because I write a lyric like, I took a pill in Ibiza to show Avicii I was cool. Well, who's going to sing that except me? Because it, no one else did it but me. So I tend to, if on one side of a spectrum is open-ended and applicable to all, and on the other side is like specific and honest, I tend to fall on the specific honest side.
What do you mean by
meaning
that?
Meaning my lyrics will be like very specific to my life, and someone else, while they might be a great singer and they might actually love the song, is not like Justin Bieber is not going to sing that because it doesn't make any sense. Like, he didn't live that. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't make any sense for him to sing that. So in those years where I was trying to be a writer, I found a lot, I just writing music that's just staying on my laptop because no one else is going to put on their album. And that's why I like being an artist, because I get to create. It's incredible. There's these little universes, and most of life is not like that. You can't make it how you want. But in my music, I can put a trumpet, and then I get to decide how loud the trumpet is and which frequencies are EQ'd out, and if I put a phaser or a flange effect on it or an echo effect. Like, it's my world, and I get to do it exactly how I want, and I love it. And so, there's other people that help me, but at the end of the day, it's like when I'm doing an album, I'm doing an album, and I get to create something that didn't exist before.
I mean, I'm sure like a lot of people are probably listening to this and saying, oh, I wish that was me, because they're sitting, you know, let's say the average job people have, they took because of those kind of the standard path of living in this world and paying the bills and mm-hmm. so on. And they never got a chance for whatever reason to discover what they thought their talents were. And we'll get into it, but you have certainly had your ups and downs since that first success. But I'm really curious about that initial spark that lit the fire.
Yeah.
And like, how do you think, like obviously you kept pursuing from 8 to 20 this passion you had. Was there anything that wanted to slow you down, or when you were in school, were your friends and teachers encouraging and your parents encouraging?
Yeah, I thought I was ready the whole time. Like when I was 10, I thought I was the best rapper. I thought I was going to get signed at like 11 and be a famous kid, white rapper.
Who were your favorite rappers then?
Ooh, then...
because at that moment...
At the very beginning, my favorite rappers were like DMX and Mystical. Then shortly thereafter, I transferred to like more, I guess you'd call it, for lack of a better term, conscious rap. Some of the people are on the walls of the studio that recorded here. It's like Big L was on this wall. Nas was one of my favorites. Actually, my favorite for a while. The Roots, J Dilla, Talib Kweli, guys like that. And to answer your question, when I first started rapping, I had some older cousins that rapped. Tulsi Anderson, who's MC, Underground MC, great MC in Seattle, and Eli Sweet in Atlanta. And they were so encouraging. You know, like I'd type these raps out in like Microsoft Word. It was very nerdy, and I'd print them out. And
would you ever, would they ever use any of the raps that you typed out? Did you consider
No, they wouldn't
route?
Use mine. They were terrible, you know. But they would give me feedback that was honest but also encouraging. And then I started to battle the other, like if there were other kids at my school that rapped, you know, we'd do what's called a battle. It's basically you like insult each other with rhythm and rhyme.
And you make it up on the fly.
You make it up on the fly. And I just thought I was the greatest. And I don't, I can't remember ever losing one. So I would do that at school, and I would get definitely a bump. I like the attention from that for sure.
So it was fueling some sense of self-worth.
Yeah, I wanted to be noticed. I think like a lot of kids, I won't speak for a lot of kids, but for me, I felt small. I was physically small. I didn't grow till I was 18. So I was always like, if not the shortest kid in my grade, one of them. And I wanted to be noticed. I wanted to feel, I felt special, but like people didn't see how special I was. So it's kind of like a cry, you know, or like a waving of a flag, like, you know, notice me.
And was it a way, let's say you're having these battles on the playground and then you go back into school. Was there a certain respect accorded because you were like kind of, people felt you were rising up in this skill?
Yeah, I felt like there was respect. I also felt there was a disrespect too because I was a white person doing hip hop. So I felt a little bit that people thought I was being inauthentic. Or
despite the fact that Eminem comes from Detroit and...
Yeah, but still, I mean, he was an anomaly, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, he still is. He's maybe one of the best rappers ever. But now, I mean, there's many, many, many white rappers because of him. I guess I was one of the people like that came after him and he paved the way. But there was still a stigma to it, you know, I felt. I think hip-hop music in general is like, oh, you're not intelligent because you rap. And that always bothered me too. Because I felt like that didn't fit. Like, no, I'm in all the AP classes and I have straight A's. But
you went to Duke University. You know, I just have to tell you a story. I went, okay. I didn't go to Duke, but when I was in 7th, 8th, and 9th grade, you probably know of it, I went to the TIP program in the summers at Duke. So it was a program where 7th graders could take college courses. Mm. So those 3 summers in a row, I went to Duke. So I'm very familiar with.
I vaguely remember that, like little geniuses walking around.
That was, yeah, I was the stupidest one in the program.
No, that's how I felt at Duke too, by the way. I felt like I was the smartest kid in my high school. And when I got to Duke, I felt like I was the dumbest kid in my college.
Well, maybe we all go through that a little. But like, and, you know, and this is, I didn't know we're going to go in this direction. I'm going to get back to my,
There's one question that I sidestepped that's bothering me right now. I didn't answer, which was, you asked me how people got the word out after it was on iTunes U. Can I just say the answer quickly?
Yeah, because it's going to be
in the back of my head the rest of the time. So the tangent we went on was like that. I think the music was actually good for the first time in my life after 12 years. So that helped. But I also just made a Facebook event and invited all my friends. And I found, and searched online like the easiest way for my friends to invite all their friends. And I sent an email to all my buddies and it was like 5 quick steps that they can invite all their friends. So suddenly the friends I had from high school who were at different colleges were inviting all their friends. And, you know, some of the people liked the stuff. I'm sure some of the people hated it, but some of the people liked the stuff and then told others. And so that's really how I got started. I started getting booked to play at other schools. There were YouTube videos of, you know, people singing all the words of my songs at my shows. And that's when record labels like, oh, there's a fire started. Maybe we should pour some gas on this one because there's some sparks flying.
You know, it reminds me in a weird way of 50 Shades of Grey, the book. And I'll tell you how.
Okay.
You probably,
I don't know anything about it.
So 50 Shades of Grey is maybe one of the best-selling books in history now, but it's basically this softcore porn book. And it was the number one book on Amazon for like a year, sold 100 million copies. And but originally it was self-published. Like she just uploaded it to Amazon and she had kind of a social media community of fans of the movie Twilight that she would write fan fiction for. She converted that fan fiction into this book. And then what happened was Simon Schuster noticed it, or Random House, one of these big publishing companies noticed it, mm-hmm. and then bought it from her after she sold about 250,000 copies. Yeah. And she said, okay. And then it became the fan, the fire. Yeah. And again, I think people need to figure out always whether they're, you know, with their talents and skills, sometimes the gatekeepers won't recognize the talent and skill. That's why they're a gatekeeper and not an artist. Yeah. Not saying anything bad about them. They wanted to be a gatekeeper.
They're doing their job.
Yeah. But you know? But sometimes you have to figure out, a gatekeeper might not say yes to you, so you have to figure out another way. Mm-hmm. And that's a little bit what many people do right now. And you were doing it with iTunes U and then with this Facebook Live event and figuring out how to get through, you know, people to come to that.
Yeah. It was just a Facebook event. I don't know if they had Facebook Live. It was just a regular old event. And it had a link to the iTunes U.
Oh,
and
good.
So yeah, just... you know, spread the word that way.
And that first song, or the first song that was a hit out of that, Cooler Than Me, it's very relatable because it's got kind of the dance thing going on, but it's also got, you know, the lyrics are very beautiful. But even the title, Cooler Than Me, is self-deprecating. Everyone every college kid could sort of relate to it. And in 2009, the country was going through a financial crisis. We all felt a little scared. I wonder if in a weird way it kind of tapped into that as well.
It could be. The song actually was out for 2 years before it became a air quotes hit. So I, you know, like my little mixtape audience that I garnered had heard it. And then I made another mixtape, like I mentioned earlier, and I was doing my little tours. And by then I had signed to J Records. It was a subsidiary of Sony. And I was working on an album, and my manager at the time, Daniel Weissman, said, we should put Cooler Than Me out as your single. I said, it's 2 years old and everyone's heard it. He looked at me and he said, no one has heard it.
That's so smart, actually.
No one's heard it. And
we all think we have this audience,
yeah.
But the reality is there's a 7 billion people on the planet.
No one's heard it. And so he hired what's called an independent radio promoter, because my label was doing, as we discussed, what labels doing. We're going to throw a budget, but we're not really doing anything. Yeah. We're waiting to see what you're going to do. And so he hired they call it independent radio promoter. We pay this guy maybe, I think, $5,000 in total. And his job is to help get songs on the radio. He has relationships at different radio stations. So he took this remix of Cooler Than Me that a guy in the original Cooler Than Me I produced, and Big Sean's on it. And then this really talented producer named Gigamesh in Minnesota did a remix of Cooler Than Me. So this independent radio promoter took the remix to these radio stations. He was in Sacramento, in LA. A lady named Patty Moreno played it, and she put in what's called power rotation. So like on a radio station, they put in like, you know, like they can play it like at nights very late, but the highest one is power rotation. They're playing it 50 times a week. She put in power rotation. She just, I don't know, she liked it, and she was just brave and courageous.
And a great market, LA.
And this was in Sacramento.
Sacramento.
And...
so not a great market.
And it just, I think, like, they do research somehow. I think they like call out, and it like reacted really well. And so then I think LA played it, and then my label said, wow, a fire's really started. And then they, okay, this really is your single, and they actually started promoting it, and it became this song, big song around the world.
Let's stop to take a quick break. We'll be right back. People look for the shortcut, the hack. But the shortcut is a lie, and the hack will never get you there. And if you want to take the easy road, it won't take you to where you want to be. Stronger, smarter, faster, healthier, better, free. There is no easy way. There is only one way, and that is the way of discipline, which is why I'm happy to recommend the book by my good friend, Discipline Equals Freedom, by Jocko Willink. Jocko is a decorated Navy SEAL, co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Extreme Ownership, and creator of the number one iTunes business podcast, The Jocko Podcast. His new book, Discipline Equals Freedom, delivers strategies and tactics for conquering weakness, procrastination, and fear. Find your will, find your discipline, and you will find your freedom. Discipline Equals Freedom. Get after it with Jocko Willink. Discipline Equals Freedom is available wherever books are sold from St. Martin's Press. Before we get into kind of like, there's this whole period of what happens next. You kind of go through your 40 days in the desert, almost literally. There's two kind of questions I just have for myself, and I don't even know if anyone in the audience is going to care, but rap, a lot of people think, oh, rap is just someone saying rhymes, but it's not. Like, what are some of the subtle, I think with any difficult skill, there are subtle nuances that most people don't understand or can hear. But like, as you were developing a skill, 8, 9, 14 years old, 15 years old, what were some of the nuances that were developing for you? Once you achieve them, you realize, oh, I needed to learn that skill and I didn't know that before.
Oh, hip hop, if we're asking about hip hop specifically, and to be clear,
rap specifically.
To be clear, like I would consider myself now a singer first, but well, then, yeah.
By
then
the way,
I
you're not a rapper now at all. I would say
I rap every now and then. I freestyle, and every once in a while, I rap on a song. But yeah, so, but to answer your question, I think I can answer the question. I mean, one is the voice, which we mentioned earlier. I mean, you're recording. People are listening to your voice. You know, so part of it you're born with, right? Your voice. Two, like it's as simple as what they call breath control. Mm. Like, can you not run out of breath when you're rapping? And then
most— See, I wouldn't think that.
Most notably is what they call flow. So flow is like the actual rhythm of what you're saying and how it sounds and it like how it flows out of your mouth. And hip hop, I believe, was started in 1979, maybe 76. Kool Herc's first DJ. So, I don't know, you do the math on that. Hip hop's been around for a while. It's been a lot of MCs and a lot of raps written. So, to create a flow that is not derivative of someone else's flow, like a new style, a new way the words flow out, and I mean specifically like the rhythm, is really hard. So you'll hear like Drake or Kendrick Lamar, these guys have flows that they created, and you'll hear people copy their flow. Or Big Sean, like, and he didn't have it when I first met him. He was kind of rapping like other people, and I was making beats like other people, but now he's at the point where he can create a flow that didn't exist before.
Well, so like, let's say in the very beginning, it was very just standard rhyme kind of flow.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, and if you go back in early hip hop, call me Sire, yeah. You know? And like you have Biggie's like, B-I-G-P-O-P-P-O-P-P-A, no info, for the D-E-A, you know, so it's a different rhythm to it. So yeah, flow is like really, really, really important. And then like the rhyme schemes, like the hip hop I listened to growing up was all about how many, instead of just like the last line, the last syllable of a line rhyming, there'd be what I call complex rhyme schemes. So like even in Cooler Than Me, I did one, which I thought was cool to sing one. So you got designer shades just to hide your face. So in addition to shades and face rhyming, designer and hide your also rhyme. So it's like an internal rhyme scheme. And there's a lot of guys who specialize in just that. Their songs tend to not make a whole lot of sense, but like everything's rhyming, you know? And then there's MCs like Eminem who can make like 7-syllable complex rhymes, but he's still making perfect sense and telling a story at the same time. That's kind of like the perfect storm and like a really special MC that comes around like once in a decade or something.
And I feel also like later on, things became a little bit more arrhythmic. So not always kind of everything falling on the beat.
Yeah, I mean, what's special about hip-hop now, a lot of people complain about, they call it mumble rap. You'll hear a lot, if you listen to like urban stations, hear a lot of guys that aren't doing complex rhymes. It's like, can sound very simple, but it sounds really good. Their voices sound good. The flow is maybe not super complex, but it's like the jazziness is kind of in hip-hop right now, the music. There's a lot of musicality to it.
And then it seems like, again, like this was a skill you developed along with kind of figuring out how to take it from your head to
I
the page.
I forgot a big one. I'm sorry to interrupt
Tell me.
You.
Tell me. I love you interrupting. Yeah. Usually I interrupt all the time. You should interrupt constantly.
Yeah, maybe the biggest one in hip hop is authenticity. So in pop music, I mean, a lot of times, like we mentioned, someone writes a song, someone else sings it, etc. In hip hop, telling the truth is a big deal. And if it's found out that you're not telling the truth, it can end your career. And so like we saw this with Drake a couple years ago. There was some leak on the internet that basically what happened was there's a leak of someone else singing what sounded like a demo reference of a Drake song. So like it sounded like a song someone else did, they sent to Drake and then he sang it. And it was this huge controversy. Well, that would never be a controversy in pop music because everyone knows Rihanna doesn't write her songs. It's fine. She's a star, amazing singer, amazing performer. Other people write her song, no problem. Frank Sinatra didn't write songs, you know, no problem. In hip hop, it's kind of a problem, you know. And maybe that's changing, but authenticity is a big, do people believe what you're saying?
So how do you, I think authenticity occurs in a lot of areas of life. So let's say writing, or I'm going to take it very base, but even like sales, like you can't sell something you don't believe in. And mm-hmm. to some extent, what you're doing with art is, you know, you're creating something that you believe in and you have to sell it to the world in a weird way somehow. Mm-hmm. Not like, oh, buy this piece of art, but you have to somehow impress upon the world that this is worth having or worth listening to or paying attention to. So how do you tap into that authenticity? Or how did you as a 20-year-old start to tap into that authenticity?
I think I started telling the truth.
Like what was a before and after?
Well, like maybe a lot of it's like bragging. A lot of my songs when I was a kid were about how good I was at rapping. So like rapping about rapping. And like you mentioned in Cool, the music self-deprecating is true. Like I wasn't good at talking to girls. I'm still not really.
You wrote a blog post. I'm interrupting you now. You wrote a blog post. It's hard to talk to famous girls.
Yeah, or maybe
and you already were super famous.
It's relative.
So maybe recount that story for a second, just because I feel it's related to Cooler Than Me, even though the events were six years later.
Yeah, it's like I always find it so weird and awkward when there's a famous female around and there's always like bodyguards and things around, you know, and that sometimes I would act like cold towards them because I felt in some like backwards logic that makes no sense, which is basically like, well, everyone's nice to them, so I'll be mean to them and they'll think I'm special. And it's just stupid. And then I was just like not being nice to someone, you know.
So again, no matter what, it's hard to tap into that authenticity. It requires this constant noticing of yourself, like what you're doing, so that you could say, oh, I shouldn't be mean in this situation. It's not authentic to me. I'm a nice person. Mm. I should just do what I do.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's hard, though, to constantly notice what's happening because everybody scares us.
Everyone scares us. And also, that can be exhausting if you're always looking at yourself instead of just being yourself.
Yeah.
You know? I think it's a balance, you know, of reflection and for the purpose of improvement, but also a realization I'm here, I'm whole, I'm complete right now. And while there are things I may want to learn to do or change, that's fine. But there were things in the past that I wanted to learn and change, and that got me to here. So I want to enjoy being here also. Like our whole life, all the work you and I have done, everything, and a lot of, you know, we really worked hard, didn't we? It put us right here in this chair.
This is where we are.
This is what we got to show for it.
This is sort of a weird elephant in the room, but being a junior at college and starting to go on tours and having people around the country listening to your music, how did that feel? That must have been a pretty great feeling.
It felt great, and then it felt overwhelming, James. It felt like,
I can't imagine.
As I touched on earlier, like this, like I felt people didn't notice me. I wanted to be noticed, and then all of a sudden, everyone's noticing me. And it was overwhelming to me. I didn't know how to deal with it.
At first it must have been nice.
It's cool. I mean, it still is nice if someone walks on the street and says, "Hey, Mike Posner, I enjoy your music." I mean, that's the best. "Hey, man, love your stuff." You know, that's the best. But at the time, when you graduate high school, kind of each year, more and more friends fall away. And then you're sort of left with your real friends, I would say. And I was close enough to high school that all those friends, those like periphery friends, they were kind of in a gray area of, are we still friends? And so when my music became popular, everyone, you know, out of the goodness of their heart, they all wanted to say congrats and talk to me. And I just felt like stretched, like I didn't have time to talk to everyone. And at times I still feel stretched, you know, like, and I would say I stretch myself, you know, because every relationship I have because I'm in it, you know, I'm deciding to be in it. But I felt overwhelmed. And when Cooler Than Me, you know, was my first single and it became this big thing, I felt like that's what happens when I put a single out. I had this, you know, I knew statistically and intellectually that artists put songs out and every once in a while they have a hit. You know, they're lucky if they get one. They're even lucky if they get two. I felt like, well, I'm different. Like, I put my first one was a hit. So, like, all of mine will be hits now.
And then what happened? Like, then you started...
Then each song I put out after that was progressively less and less popular. And I progressively became less and less popular until I was left alone in a million-dollar house in L.A. with an empty schedule and sort of nothing to do.
And obviously that's depressing, but because it's depressing in a variety of ways. One is you probably had these, as you said, you thought everything was going to be hits. You had these kind of preconceived goals and you spent the money a little bit. And then the other thing is, you know, just this natural thing, which we were talking about slightly before the podcast started, I imagine you attached a little bit of your self-worth to those numbers.
Yeah, I touched not only my self-worth, but my self-identity. Like, who I actually thought I was Mr. Popular, Mr. Successful. And suddenly those things were gone. Like, they actually weren't there. And so I had to literally redefine how I thought of who I was. And it was the best thing that ever could have happened to me.
Which people always say after the fact.
Yeah.
But as you could probably attest, feels really bad at the bottom.
At the time, I wanted to, and I want to be clear, like, my bottom was still pretty high. Like, I had saved my money and...
You did better than me then.
I was, while I, like, was searching internally and felt confused and lost, I wasn't, like, scrounging for rent or anything like that. So I want to make that clear.
You know? And is that because you were also, I mean, at that time... You know, with the million-dollar house in L.A., and you had saved some money, but you were also—I imagine—and I don't know this for sure—I imagine you were getting some work, doing some writing for other songwriters.
Yeah, I was still like, yeah, actually, that part of my career was actually doing kind of well. You know, I had the song for Justin Bieber, "Boyfriend," which became a hit, and the song for Maroon 5,
so, number one hit on Billboard.
Yeah, they did well, but I wanted to be an artist still. You know, and I wanted to sing more. I felt like I had more to say. And so, you know, in the music industry, my artist career was largely considered over. Wow, my songwriting career was doing well. Like, people called me to write, but I didn't really want to write for other people that much. Like, I wanted to write for me and say what I wanted to say for the reasons I talked about earlier. And I was just kind of, it was considered over. Like, I was considered a one-hit wonder because I was at the time. You know, I had one hit.
Does that, like all the time people sort of make fun of one-hit wonders?
Yeah.
And now you were suddenly feeling it like, oh my gosh, I'm one of them.
Yeah, I can joke about it now because I had another hit. But at the time, like, it really bothered me. It really bothered me because there was the underlying implication of a one-hit wonder is, like, they got lucky. They weren't really talented. Right, and it's kind of like got this luck, and it didn't last, and it didn't last because they weren't actually good, which is how maybe that's just how I always looked at one hit wonders, but that's how I thought about them, like, growing up as a kid.
Did you consider that you might not be good at that time? I mean, you were getting
really
some...
interesting. Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. Because actually, honestly, I wasn't good at singing. I wasn't good at instruments. I didn't play any. And I wasn't good at singing because I just started singing a few years ago. And so I looked at myself and I thought, yo, maybe I'll take this time to actually get better. And so I took a lot of vocal lessons. I took a lot of piano lessons. I took a lot of guitar lessons. I'm still a beginner at all those things. But I mean, it's like maybe a little bit of a brag, but I'm really proud. Like in January, I played on the Jimmy Kimmel Show alone with me and a guitar.
Were you scared?
Not really that scared because it'd been years since I started and I played a lot with my guitar, like to the point at the beginning, like where I really stunk at it. And for me to be able to do that alone was a huge internal triumph for me because at that time after Cool & Me, I didn't play guitar at all and I really couldn't sing either. And so to be able to do that, like, it was awesome for me. It's awesome for me.
So you started doing these things. I mean, one kind of takeaway from that is that when you do kind of feel these negative things that are really not doing you any service. So if you say to yourself, I feel I might be a one-hit wonder, blah, blah, blah. That's not really helping you in any way to have those thoughts. Instead, what helps you is to say, okay, I'm feeling bad artistically, so let's figure out some of these other skills in this art that I love and try to get better at them. And that's what you did. You kind of, and you took some ego out of it, like, let's start day one with piano lessons. And so going from a negative to, and reaching for that positive is a good start to get out of that bottom. And then what else, like... You took physical actions.
Well, over the real answer, there's other like kind of cool stories, but the real answer is I believe in the law of attraction, which is maybe simply oversimplifying is you get what you think about. So if you believe you're a one-hit wonder, you're going to get more of your one-hit wonder. But at the time, like I drilled in my mind, would meditate and picture and visualize, I believed I was a one-hit wonder then, but it was all going to work out. And I believed I'd get a new record deal and I would have another hit. I convinced myself I would, that it was on its way.
But that would probably lead to action.
Yeah,
I think some people just say, I want tickets to Mexico to show up in my mailbox, that probably won't happen. Mm-hmm. But if you say, I want to go to Mexico and really meditate in it and believe in it and stuff, you'll start to notice all the different ways. Oh,
yeah.
I could hitch this ride to Mexico. I just noticed it on the board or at the shopping mall or
it's
whatever.
It's more in your purview.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I believe, and logically that just makes sense. Without any spiritual woo-woo, it's like, okay, I'm telling myself that it's on its way, so I'm gonna notice the doors, if we want to use that metaphor. Yeah. I'm gonna notice the open doors more now than if I just assumed all doors are shut.
And I'm not discounting the woo-woo aspect because I'm sure because you're reaching deep into yourself
but
it
makes sense though.
Yeah, and I think though many people when we just say the phrase law of attraction, people don't understand there's probably like a boundary there where. Okay, it's almost like you're going deeper within to make sure this is something you will notice. And it could be because you're touching something spiritually inside. It could be mentally, emotionally. But then, like you say, you start to notice the doors more easily. Mm-hmm. That becomes a talent you develop for these specific things that you want. Yeah. So then you were doing that, but then what were the actions that then happened? And you could tell a cool story if you want.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ones. I mean, in that time I met this spiritual teacher named Ram Dass, and he really inspired me from just how loving he was. I had a meeting with just him and like two other friends, and he looked at us with these big eyes of like unconditional love. And he told us, he said, you spend all day deciding what to love and what not to love. He said, that's too hard. It's too exhausting. He said, just love everything. I thought
That's pretty good. I'm going to use that.
Yeah, it's so...
I'm going to steal
it's
that.
It's so simple, but like is actually very, very profound. Like to walk out and actually choose to love what's going wrong. Choose to love what doesn't matter. Choose to love everything. So there was that, and he inspired me. And so I sort of took on a bit of a yogic lifestyle after that, because I thought, well, I want to have eyes like that. I want to make people feel that way. And I wanted to see if I could be happy without all my stuff that I had garnered. And I had realized that, you know, from the amassing of my stuff, my money and my notoriety and my sports car, that I kind of felt like the same. It didn't make me less happy, but it didn't really make me more happy. And so I thought, maybe I'll try out leaving all that. So I bought this this Dodge conversion van. I think it's like a 94 Dodge conversion. In the back has like bench seats that fold down into a bed. It's like a little longer than a normal passenger van, like maybe 2 feet longer. And I packed up like the clothes that fit in it, my guitar, some like my computer, a keyboard, and I donated the rest of the clothes that I had in my house. Like whatever didn't fit in it, I just donated, and I just drove away from LA. I just drove away, and I ended up in Utah, where I had some friends there in the mountains, and I was hanging out. I went to Burning Man. So I found I was pretty happy that whole time.
So what happens? Like, let's say you're playing a guitar at Burning Man. People don't know who you are. Mm-hmm. They don't know you've had all these, you know, these hits, you know, and you're working with all these great, you know, artists and performers. Were people noticing and saying, hey, this guy's got something?
Yeah, some of it. So it's interesting. I just got back from Burning Man a month or so ago for the second time. At Burning Man, there's no money. So you can't buy or sell anything. And it's explicitly not a barter system either. It's a gifting system. So people would just come up to you and say, hey, I want you to have this. And you don't have to give anything back. It's not expected you give anything back in return. So it's a big distinction about Burning Man. Like, I feel a misconception that it's bartering. You're trading. You're not trading. You come with something to give, and you just give it to people like unabashedly. So one of the things I came to give with was my music. I had just rode around with my guitar on my back, and I'd ride up to people and say, hey, you want to hear a song? And they'd look at me kind of skeptically and say, okay. And I'd play something for them. Sometimes I'd freestyle something for them about like their surroundings or them. And they'd look at me and be like, you got it, man. You got to pursue music. You got to go for it.
That's really funny.
And I would say thank you.
And when you're freestyling like that, does that draw upon the experiences all the way from when you were 10 years old doing battles in the playground?
Yeah, it totally drew upon it. And at the time, it was a skill that I thought I lost totally, because I hadn't used it in many, many years. And in this environment where I had no fear of failure, because it didn't matter if I messed up a line or couldn't come up with a word in time, I found I hadn't really missed a beat. Like, the skills were all there.
You know what would be interesting is if you kind of just impromptu got a small venue in like LA or whatever, and totally like, you know, small audience, 50 to 100 people, and just freestyled for an hour.
An hour. I've never done that ever. Maybe I should do it at home first.
Just to kind of like build, like really kind of.
The muscle.
Yeah. Exercise that muscle in a really hard way.
Yeah.
Because you already have it, right? It's already built up, but you know, like you said, you didn't know if you still had it, but like just to really get uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
Might be fun.
It would be fun. I find that a lot when I'm camping or something, I'm able to. And this was the thing I first did, but I was able to freestyle songs. So not just like, you know, when I was a kid, I freestyle a verse, you know, just like a rap. But then I stumbled on this ability to like, I could sing a chorus and then I'd freestyle a verse. And if I'm not too far in my own head, I can remember the chorus and sing it again, and then freestyle another verse, remember the chorus, and sing the chorus again. And really good, like, it's a chorus that other people can join in. And that's sort of like the second iteration of freestyling for me now.
So you went to Burning Man that first time. You've been taking piano lessons, guitar lessons, vocal lessons, and you're probably still building the career of writing for others. But then you, boom, start creating your own stuff again, which of course the next great hit, which is now almost hitting a billion views on YouTube. I took a pill in Ibiza. What kind of led to that?
Well, I think I'd actually already written it by the time I took off in my van and maybe even recorded it. And it was out. And sort of that core Mike Posner audience, maybe, I don't know how many of them there are, but probably in the tens of thousands, not million, like in the ten. I have like this really amazing loyal group of supporters that, like, they support me and they care about me and they're wonderful people. And they had heard my recording of it, and it was sort of like just known amongst them until these men in Norway named CB, and very similar to Cooler Than Me, or Gigamesh remix Cooler Than Me, CB remixed I Took a Pill in Ibiza. And the original I Took a Pill in Ibiza is slow, it's good guitar, I produced it.
Yeah, and another one you specifically emphasize the decibels of the lyrics, so the words come out.
Yeah, yes, in that you're right. You did your homework.
And bam,
in that album, I said on Tony Maserati's legendary mixer, I said, you know, to turn the vocal up 3 dB louder the whole album than you normally would, so you could really hear the word, because the words were like kind of the album, and. It's easy to lose the words if you don't produce it right.
And the words were really important to you, because this was sort of like you wrote this at a time when you were somewhat distraught and trying to figure out your own path to happiness, and it was confusing.
Yeah, I was just trying to be honest about the period after Cooler Than Me, where my self-identity that I created was wrong and got destroyed, and which was a beautiful thing, and I wouldn't trade it for anything, but just be honest about what that process was like. And so that album is called At Night Alone. It came out, and these guys, CB in Norway, they remixed this song. And to be clear, what remixing means they took the vocal track from my original and they got rid of all the music. So it's just my vocal. They sped it up, so it was going faster, and they made all new music to it. So they basically made a whole new song. And that's what a good remix is. It's a whole new song.
And I think if you compare the two, you recognize your voice, obviously, in both, in the lyrics, but they're completely different songs.
Yeah, yeah. You're
like your original with the remix.
Yeah, and like I said, this I started out doing remixes. I'm glad we got to talk about that, because a big question I always get is, are you upset they ruined your song? They changed it. Say, no, I love remix. Like, I started off doing remixes. I believe in the ethos of the remix, and, like, you know, in hip hop, that's the culture of sampling, of taking old art and making new art out of it. Something like Andy Warhol being able to put the Campbell soup can in his painting and make a new piece of art out of it. And so sometimes I'm Andy Warhol and sometimes I'm the Campbell soup can, you know, and that's okay. It's valuable both ways. And
I would say all art to some extent has remix aspects to it.
Yeah, has to.
And
right?
people, you know, there's a book I once read, The Anxiety of Influence, and it was about poets and how they didn't want to be compared to the prior generation, because they're like, no, I'm not like Ezra Pound or whatever, because there was a certain anxiety being, oh, you got this idea from the last generation. But actually, it's a very powerful thing to learn from the prior, you know, generation and so on, and to mix and match. Andy Warhol did that, and Roy Lichtenstein certainly did that in pop, and rap is completely that, you know, not 100%, but a lot of it is that.
Yeah, sure. Hip hop started, they take what they call the break of a soul record, which was like a really cool instrumental part usually of a soul song or an older song, and they just loop that part because or it's something they call it the get down, where like that was the best part, and that was how hip hop started, and then people would rap over that, so then they put new drums to that, etc. So yeah, these guys did this remix of this song, and that song, their version, became this really, and I'm in the mountains in Utah with a beard down to my chest, and my manager's telling me this song is number one on Spotify in Norway, and I'm like, that's wild, you know, and I could sort of see it coming.
Do it, benefit? I guess I have to ask, do you benefit financially as that one does well?
Yeah, definitely. Because how it works is the song, usually a remix and there's nuances to it, but if I write the song, I'm still the writer of the song. And if someone remixes the song, it's still in the law. And like I said, there's nuances and you can do a deal however you want to do it. But in the law, technically, like, I'm still my song. And there's a difference between a producer and a writer. So like, when someone writes a song, like there's a wonderful writer named Diane Warren. She writes songs, she doesn't produce them. So someone like produces one of her songs, they get maybe a royalty and sometimes money in advance up front. But the publishing, the writing, it's still her song. So they don't get a piece of the actual writing. So like if someone else sings the song or it gets put in a movie, yes, I still get paid for that.
And so you know, alongside of all of this, you also wrote a book of poetry, Teardrops and Balloons.
Yeah.
And a lot of it also, I think, was kind of a outlet for you to kind of get out this, you know, sort of these truths inside of you that didn't necessarily fit into a song format. Like, what was the genesis of you've played around with a couple different genres of art now.
Well, I'd been writing poetry for a while.
Like, what's the difference between a poem and song lyrics?
Great question.
It's a stupid question, too.
No, it's not a stupid question.
But I ask it anyway.
And I wish I had a more concrete answer, but my answer is when they come out of me, they feel different. And there's a little cross. Sometimes I'll steal a line from a poem, put it in a song. Usually not the other way around. But I just kind of know right at the beginning, this is a poem or this is a song. And sometimes, I mean, poetry, I think, is in a lot of ways harder. And I don't mean more difficult. I mean like hard, like more Detroit harder, like more raw, like more real. Because you can just say it. You know, a lot of times in a song, I'm trying to fit it to a certain rhythmic pattern or rhyme with something. And there's plenty of songs where I don't rhyme or just go off the charts or off the deep end with rhythm. But in poetry, I think maybe because I know less about it, I'm less schooled in it. Like I haven't read all the poetry as, I haven't read as much poetry as I've listened to music. And so I just do it. And I love being able to express myself both ways. And so I mean, to really answer the question, I had this like growing mound of poems for all these years. And I ran into a friend who runs a small publishing house and offered to publish the poems. And then finally, like, these things are going to have a home, you know? So, and it was this fun process of like going through notebooks and going through old iPhones and finding all the poems and which ones, like, it was cool because I felt like a real editor because I didn't remember the poems. So I could actually read them with fresh eyes and know if they stunk or not. And just picking which ones didn't, in my opinion, and putting them in the book. And then drawing, the book has like lots of drawings and illustrations. So like doing that and nerding out with my friend Eric Gorvin, listening to Jay Dilla for hours and just getting the illustrations and drawings perfectly right. It was just fun, man.
And then you also have a podcast that you just started. And now I actually listen to them, but now I'm forgetting.
It's called What Does This All Mean?
What does this all mean?
I remember the name.
Yeah. And it was beautiful, the last one about your father and your visit to your father's grave.
Thank you.
And there's like, you also have this, there's like a musical feeling, you know, this, you're playing music in there. And it's beautiful. It's very kind of impassioned. And I wonder where you see your podcast going. Because that's an art form too.
It is, and it's a lot of fun because I feel I'm able, I record myself since I was a little kid. Like I plug my microphone through a couple of contraptions into my laptop and I hit record. And so I have this kind of superpower where I can just make stuff and I can make music too. So getting able to throw all these these skills together is really fun for me. And I feel like I'm, yeah, in a new medium. But to answer the question, I feel really lucky that at 22, I had all this money and notoriety and attention from the opposite sex. And it became really apparent to me that that wasn't the magic bullet in life. And I was someone who, if I didn't amass those things, would probably always believe that it was the magic bullet until I found out for myself. So I feel
But really, could someone say, oh, it's easy for him to say, yeah, now that he's amassed these things, that it's not the magic bullet?
Sure, I was that guy. Mm-hmm. I was that guy that before. Mm-hmm. And I understand being that guy, because there's some lessons that you just have to learn for yourself. You know, and maybe it is the magic bullet for someone else. I don't know. But for me, this is my truth. And so what happened was, it wasn't the magic bullet for me. And so I started asking the question, if not that, then what? And my podcast is a chronicling of me asking that question in different ways. So, you know, starting with my father passing away in January and being reminded that I will too pass away soon. My time is finite here. I began setting on this path of like kind of asking this question, trying to figure things out. So one of the things I did was like I took this self-development course called the Landmark Forum.
Oh yeah, I know of it.
I did that, and I did a podcast about that after. That's coming soon. I also spent a week in solitude this summer where I had no human contact for 7 days, and I did a podcast about that after.
So what was that like? I don't think I could do that.
Man, what part of that? James, I never knew how long a day was. A day is forever. And, you know, I wanted to see who I was when I had nothing to accomplish. So literally, like, I took away anything, any, like, task. Like, I didn't, you know, there's nothing I could do to improve myself or work, and which was like my MO, like maybe became my self-identity, like the searcher guy. So like there was nothing to do. And the first thing my brain did was made something up to do. Like, oh, I need to organize like these spices over here that, you know, or I need to like run up this hill 3 times for exercise. So it made me think, I mean, for I mean, that's in like the first 20 minutes. It's like, how much of my life am I creating tasks that I don't actually care about just to feel busy? Because I'm scared of sitting alone by myself in a room.
I think that's a lot of people. I mean, I think that's...
Oh, it's maybe all people.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true for me.
Have you heard that quote, all of man's problems stem from the fact that he cannot sit quietly alone in a room?
I haven't heard that quote, but it makes sense.
Yeah, I forget who said it, but it's a good one. And it turns out doing nothing is maybe the hardest thing to do. So there were points of like really powerful insight and clairvoyance, and also really, really, really difficult parts of loneliness and despair, for sure.
What what's the difference between being alone and being lonely in that context?
I think you can be. I mean, I could be lonely right now. I could be lonely in New York City with millions and millions of people around me. Being alone, you're like, there's no one there to talk to. There's right. Like physically no one there.
And then would that then trigger more loneliness?
Like, I think it can. And that's that. I mean, that's the question, is that, and I would say it's a decision is in your own mind. Right? And that's a powerful, to realize that you have the power to, literally, like there was a moment where I was sitting on the floor in meditation in despair and loneliness, and was able to transform that into like elation. Wow. Like that. I don't know, I just sat there and like and realized like I'm alive, and changed my focus and what my attention of like, it's beautiful that I have the privilege even to do this, and that I'm in the mountains in Colorado, and all the things that are going right. And that's like, it's so like, we have the power to do that. And I'm not a master of that. There's plenty of times where I'm in a deep hole and I can't get myself out of it. But I do think we as humans have the capacity to literally snap ourselves out of despair, you know?
Well, it's interesting because I think it's hard to think your way out of despair. I think that's, thoughts are sort of like the last thing we evolved, you know, as primates. You know, there's, let's say you go from like the reptilian brain of instinct and then, you know, kind of tribal behavior where you measure your self-worth from alpha to omega, and then you sort of have thoughts and reasoning and communication. But I think you have constantly put yourself in a situation where you're experiencing discomfort and how you work your way through it. Like, you've exercised that muscle. Because like you say, you start off with the 20% talent. Well, that 80% takes another 12 years. And then there's the next 80% after that, of course, which everyone forgets about, which takes another 12 years and so on. It never stops. And you kind of consistently made yourself uncomfortable. So you'll spend the 7 days alone, or you'll visit your father's grave, make a podcast out of it. Like, you're constantly saying, what's the action that could, feels a little funny, but I'm going to do it and figure out my way through it.
Thank you. Yeah. And I feel, honestly, I feel lucky and blessed to have the luxury to be able to do that. Right. Like I got to take 7 days off and do nothing and be totally alone. Like, that's a privilege. Like, most people don't have the time to do that, or they have other responsibilities they have to take care of in those 7 days. They can't just totally disappear.
So what can they do?
I'm not sure. You know, everyone can maybe figure that out for themselves. But I know me personally, I used to do these things. They became, for a while, my new fancy car. Like, oh, I meditate now. You don't. So it was like my new, like, jewelry. But now I really believe that I'm really blessed to be able to even ask that question and kind of explore it a little bit. And I just want to share it. Share what I'm stumbling upon as much as I can. I mean, what can other people do? I mean, I think they can exercise, like kind of the obvious answer. They can exercise, they can meditate twice a day. That's why I do 20 minutes twice a day.
And that people always have time for, I would say.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Russell Simmons says, if you don't have 20 minutes to meditate, then you need 3 hours to meditate.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have time, you know? Your time, like, if you don't have time to be happy and enjoy, then what are you working for? What are you working for? Like, what are you working towards? Like, some fantasy day?
Well, I think that's a good question for a lot of people. I think people kind of have to kind of find that authenticity in themselves. They almost have to take out a paper, because they're not used to doing it, and list what it is they value. What's important to them, if it's not what their work is, and so on, and then try to figure out step by step how to
move it. What is it for you?
What's
important to you?
I think I like to tell my story, and in such a way that it maybe helps others listening to it. And part of the way I tell my story is by asking questions to people like you. So to figure out what makes you tick, and to ask it in ways that nobody else has asked you before. Like, I'm hoping you'll come out of this thinking, gosh, I've had lots of interviews, but no one else has asked me quite those questions before in that way. And it made me think of things. And that's what I try to do with each one of these. And I always try to make myself uncomfortable, as we discussed, and figure out how I can get through it. Where, like you've said a couple of times, I don't know what will work for them, but I know this worked for me. And I think everybody always relies on scientific research to say, oh, what's the solution to a problem? Oh, the scientific study says. Well, the best scientific study is just the only one I'm going to do with myself.
Yeah.
Not with the one with 10 million people in it, the one with me in it. And then I figure things out.
It's actually really poignant, yeah.
So what are you struggling with right now? Like, what's the next thing? You're working on so many different things.
What am I struggling with right now? I wouldn't call it a struggle. I mean, work on a new album. You know, so finishing out. I'm in a marvelous relationship with a woman named Megan out there.
Right outside. Hi, Megan.
Yes, a new thing for me.
How'd you guys meet?
To be in love is a new thing for me. And it's special.
I'm 49. I don't think I know what it feels like.
I hope you do. I didn't think I would ever feel how I feel now.
How'd you guys meet?
We met in Utah when I was living in my van. But
Like she just went up to
living
the van
is maybe too strong,
on the door.
Strong of a word.
You're in the van by the creek.
Hey babe. Come on over. No, we met she was in Utah. We met and we were kind of friends for, it was like 2 years ago. And it took me doing some of this work to realize who she actually was.
And then you just start going together. And
we start going. And it was scary. And it was for both of us. We kind of made the space to have a relationship. And then it's just like this beautiful like thing is blossoming and growing still.
Well, excellent.
Yeah.
I just want to tell the story. I want to tell you the story of this podcast.
Yeah.
Which
please.
Is that my producer or the managing director of this podcast, Steve Cohen, originally wanted me to interview Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of... We had this studio mm-hmm. booked. And he wanted me to interview the Wolf of Wall Street. You ever seen that
movie?
Are
you talking about your podcast in general or today?
Today.
Oh, today.
And
okay.
We discussed it and we discussed you. And I was like, listen, what Jordan Belfort's a criminal, or he was, I don't want to say he's a criminal right now, maybe that's too strong. He was in jail or fined or whatever, I don't even know what happened to him, but that is that whole movie with Leonardo DiCaprio.
I saw it.
And I'm like, what am I going to learn? I'm in New York City, I see plenty of people who have been in jail all the time. So here's Mike Posner, who's done all these great songs, he's had his ups and downs, he's reinvented his career many times and kind of been through all these things. Let's get him in the studio. So I really and then it was like on an hour's notice, he got in touch with you. He got in touch with me. We both converged down here. And
you did all that research that quick.
Yeah. Well, I knew of you before.
Yeah, but you did some deep diving, man. I didn't point out all the times that I was impressed by your deep diving.
Oh, I really appreciate that.
I pointed out one, but there was like three.
All right,
there
good.
There was like three.
Good. Three is the magic number. Well, I really appreciate
it
you coming
the,
down here,
It
Mike.
Was the when you said I turned the vocals up on the mixing of my album.
Yeah. Well, that was interesting because you wrote about that, that you wanted the word, and it's this idea that with the remixing, they took it back down because the EDM side became important to them, but the words were so important to you because this was about a time when you were distraught, not this happy dance song. So it was interesting to see your opinion on that, but also the conflict, the appreciation, the fact that they made their own song, and it was great.
And they did a really good job.
Yeah, so really that's so two contradictory thoughts could exist in one head, really, in one artistic, mode.
Man, I have a lot of contradictory thoughts.
But that's okay. I think that's what people
at the same time.
I think that's what people need to learn is that's where art's born from, is this man and a woman, is those contradictory thoughts almost coming together.
Do you feel that? What times you cursed to be able to see both sides of an issue?
Yeah, because you have to. Like, I'll give you an example.
You know what else is hard too? It's hard to participate for me. I mean, it's hard. Like, I find it difficult to participate in a conversation without picking one. And I notice myself like in a almost argument sometimes where I don't even really believe that side's better than the other side, but I just pick this side because the other person's on the other side, and like that's how conversations work, it seems.
I think that is a natural instinct to play the devil's advocate, right? But I think also it's a challenge, it's uncomfortable to say, oh, maybe that person's right or wrong. Like, a lot of people are one issue people in the sense that they're on this side, and if everybody's on this side, they hate them. So like, take a common issue is like pro-life or pro-choice. Mm. So one of my, in various things I do, one of my business partners is pro-life, I'm pro-choice, but then I go and see him, I never argue with anybody about their opinions because you can't change anyone's mind, but then I go see him, not just argue, but he goes out and raises foster kids who come from troubled homes. So he takes his views and takes an action that's very positive. And so who am I to argue with that?
Yeah.
Am I going to argue about his opinion even though he's going out and doing so? I don't take foster kids in.
Yeah.
And he's actually saving kids' lives.
Yeah.
And regardless of what he believes.
I think it's admirable when anyone actually lives out their beliefs.
Yeah.
Whether you agree with the beliefs or not. I think there's something to be said for someone that has the courage to like actually do what they say they believe.
And I think people who work a standard, let's say, day job, and I hate to put it that way, but they feel like, okay, there's the artist and then there's me working the standard day job. But I think anyone could be an artist in their life by living out bit by bit those beliefs, their beliefs, and bringing a little closer to the front of who they are.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest art piece you and I are working on is our lives. Like at the end of the day, that's the big painting. You know, and each day we get to add a color or maybe erase a stroke here and there, but at some point that painting's gonna be finished. But that's not, someone went up to Gandhi when he was on a train, I think in South Africa, and maybe as a journalist, and they asked, Mr. Gandhi, can you give us a quote? Can you give us a message? And he just said, my life is my message.
Yeah, and he very much lived by a code of honesty, which I think you pointed out in one of your blogs as well. He even wrote a book about his autobiography. I think it was the word truth is in the title. I forget.
My Experiments with Truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's very important to him to always live that way.
Yeah, and he actually is very similar to you in that he was testing things out for himself.
Yeah.
All the time. My experiments with truth.
Yeah.
Right? How he phrased that. My experiments with truth.
It's the only ones you can do. We don't know if anything else exists. Yeah. So, yeah. Mike Posner, once again, thank you so much for coming down here. Where I know it was like a 1 minute's notice, and then you had to
it was incredible.
Take the helicopter down.
No, I was so excited. I even told my one of my managers, Robert, I said, I'm really excited to do this today. So thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Choose Yourself Network at jamesaltucher.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Hey, thanks for listening. Listen, I have a big favor to ask you, and it will only take 30 seconds or less, and it would mean a huge amount to me. If you like this podcast, please let me know. Please let the team I work with know. Please let my guests know. And you can do this easily by subscribing to the podcast. It's probably the biggest favor you could do for me right now, and it's really simple. Just go to iTunes, search for The James Altucher Show, and click subscribe. Again, it will only take you 30 seconds or less, and if you subscribe now, it will really help me out a lot. Thanks again.